Hello and welcome, or indeed welcome back, for this is Season 1, Episode 2 of Gaming by Design. My name is Colin, and during these 7 episodes we aim to turn the magnifying glass on 7 different game mechanics that can make or ruin a game, citing as many examples as we can. We aim to be both informative and entertaining, although we make no promises, but really what we want to do is encourage you to discover and discuss the mechanics which make games work amongst yourselves. We don't profess to being experts in this subject, we're just putting our own thoughts and musings out there. And finally, it goes without saying, however we must say it because it's very important, these opinions are our own and are not those of any of our employers, either past, present or future. As always, I am joined by Encyclopedic Gamer, Richard.
Good evening, everybody.
Yes, so episode 1 is out there and on iTunes.
Yes, it is. And I'm very pleased of it.
I think it went pretty well. I've got to learn editing, speaking properly.
I need to learn how to stop going at the beginning and during and at the end of every sentence.
That's general good advice for both of us. Podcast 1, out there, morality in games, covered, except it's not fully covered, is it?
We missed, I think, one very important game in last week's discussion, and that would be Mask.
And again, it is a game that is essentially, its morality system is the gameplay.
Very much so. So yeah, I mean, for a bit of background about it, a Mask is a free-to-play flash game in which you take on the role of a fashion designer, and you need to find money to fund this fashion line or this fashion show called Mask. And basically the game follows a series of moral decisions shown as still kind of comic book images with like text to decide where to go on how you're going to get the money to fund this show, and also it deals with the relationships with your friends and your wife.
Yeah, and it is very good and we recommend it a lot, and it's a very good example of a morality based game.
What Mask does uniquely is that you get a great sense that the moral decisions compound one another. This is a thought I had about Mask, which other games, I would say, arguably not even The Witcher or its ilk do, but the moral decisions impact other moral decisions that impact moral decisions. Mask, despite its lack of any real production values and its, you know, its kind of vague cheapness, there's an amount of pressure and atmosphere to it that so many other games lack, because you can feel almost like you're digging your own grave from the weight of the actions compounding on one another.
But we're not here to talk about morality. That's what we did last time. And unfortunately, we can't cover Mask in as much detail as we should have done because we forgot about it.
Yes, we did.
It's very good. Very worth checking out. It is free. So if you want a good example of a morality-based game, go and download it. What are we here to discuss, Richard?
Well, this week, we're going to be talking about making believable characters in video games. So the question is, how do you create believable characters in games? Can you create believable characters in video games? How are these illusions shattered? Are, in fact, believable characters important? Are they possible? Basically, a lot of general chit-chat around that area, Colin. Characters.
Very good. You should get a job on a shopping channel with introductions like that.
I should do.
So I think the example that we have discussed a lot and where we got the idea for this topic from is the games of, or the modern-day games of Rockstar.
Very important to state that we're talking about the modern-day games of Rockstar, because obviously in their earlier incarnation, up to, say, the Warriors, San Andreas, they were very much in the vein of cartoony, kind of over-the-top type games.
That is true, and in particular, I'm talking about the games GTA 4 and Red Dead Redemption. If you're not aware of these games, it doesn't really matter, because we will fill you in.
Red Dead Redemption is Rockstar Games' Western epic from last year, in which you play a man called John Marsden, who is a former outlaw gone good, who is forced out of his life of quiet farming when the law enforcement agencies of the time kidnap his wife and family and force him to go after his former gang, trawling around in the Wild West, killing, looting and shooting like he used to.
So it is very much a game of redemption, although killing, looting and shooting is not really what a man trying to go straight would do.
Yes, which neatly brings us on to what I guess is the issue, if that's the correct word, with John Marsden and other characters of its ilk. The game, through its scripting and its acting and all of that, which are impeccable, paint John Marsden as a flawed but essentially heroic character, one who is trying desperately to get over the sins of his past and become a better man.
Yeah, he is trying to get back his family, basically. His family are basically being kidnapped, and so he's trying to undergo these tasks for, he's being blackmailed by law enforcement agencies, so he's going to have to go through these quite arduous tasks and quite inhumane challenges.
Yeah, and that's kind of where the problem lies. From Rockstar's side, from the developer's side, they are creating this character, this, I think, very carefully, very well-drawn character, who, if he had it his way, would stay at home on his farm with his wife and his family. His days of killing are over. But, unfortunately, that becomes somewhat at loggerheads with what actually happens in the video game Red Dead Redemption, where you play him and you could take this flawed, tragic, soulful man and shoot a horse in the head.
It is true. It is possible that they could have developed John Marston into a character where he has to do these atrocious things against what the character himself would do. And you would hope that if they wanted to make him truly believable, they would make the character object in some way or feel horrid for doing these things. But in reality, that is fairly open-ended, and he doesn't seem to have any qualms in working for both sides of two warring factions. What do you say?
I think, yeah, but in Rockstar's new incarnation as this kind of purveyor of big, cinematic, very serious, very well-made games, they've come across a situation where their previous characters, say, for example, Vice City's Tommy Vercetti, they were essentially sadists, immoral, amoral even, who would do whatever they could in order to make money, and therefore nothing that the player could do can in any way undermine the experience. In Vice City, I could just drive a scooter over some tourists, and excessive as that may seem, it fits him as a person.
Yeah, because the characters that you were playing were horrible people, and so the actions in which you were undertaking were completely within character.
Yeah, so the more that Rockstar have gone down this route, and this is very much the case of GTA 4 as well, which I guess we'll get to in a minute, is that the more they define the personality of a character, the more that is at odds with their kind of open world, do what you like gameplay aesthetic.
That is true. They're trying to make a mature character with a mature storyline, but the gameplay is still unrelentingly immature.
Yes, it's mature characters in an immature world, which I guess is something that action games in general have as a problem if they try to build any kind of serious narrative. I think it's a lot more notable in Rockstar's recent work, probably because the quality of their writing and their acting is so far ahead of almost everyone else in the industry, that when you see these essentially very believable, very sad, tragic characters come out of a cutscene, and then for you to, for example, accidentally skin a bunch of sheep and then throw dynamite at some passing strangers, that kind of illusion, that believability, that connection with the character as Rockstar have defined him is shattered.
See, what's interesting there is you're saying that the storyline, as in the pre-programmed storyline, is what makes it believable, and you think the open world is the unbelievable part, whereas I think the opposite. I think the story is the unbelievable part in which John Marston is a character who could get whatever he wants easily just through the end of his gun, and he goes through these silly, silly tasks for people, which he doesn't really need to do. He could just extract that information through these people in other ways. Whereas the open world is the more realistic world, because the hunting is very realistic. He is a farmer, and it's done in a very realistic way. And when you commit crimes in the open world, such as, you know, lassoing people and drag them along the ground, you get very heavily penalized, and you do get a bounty upon your head. And so that kind of unbelievable action is reprimanded quite greatly to try and discourage you from doing it.
Yes, definitely. Rockstar does a good job through the world, through the depth of the world, maybe through the graphics, the sound, all of that. There's kind of nuances in the gameplay that help to build Marston as a character, from the way he walks, the way he fights, the actions that he can undertake in the gameplay in the open world do, it's true, help to support him as a character and give him a kind of context in his world. But I believe that there's still a big issue here, because it almost feels like the gameplay, what the player is doing and what the developer is making, are contradictory to me. It's true, I think that there's an issue with the way that the game's progression is done. As you point out, he's basically forced into committing a series of crimes for various people who, for whatever reason, he seems like he has to do what they say. He could threaten them at any point, he could, you know, kill them, but he just does what they say.
He could just simply say no to them and not get their assistance. I mean, he works on both sides of the Civil War, and you think no one would really do that. They would maybe pick their side and go with it, and not commit atrocious crimes against both sides.
Yeah, you have a point there. Again, I think it's more the gameplay part getting in the way of the raw character part. There needs to tell a kind of a narrative that is made up of missions, and these missions that the user can participate in. Means that, yeah, you get into an absurd situation in which Jordan Mars and the Pist act utterly and bizarrely schizophrenic. There's, we have a section of it set during a Mexican Civil War in which he plays on both sides. He plays both sides against the middle. It's very similar to a lot of Western films or samurai films. You see it come up in like things like Rashomon. But there doesn't appear to be a reason why he's doing it. In those films, there's a kind of personal profit, a gain from it. He works both sides against the middle just because they ask him to do things. And I think it's that need to always think about things in terms of when can the player get involved now that means that increasingly the character acts strangely.
And another example is, do you remember when he first gets to Mexico and he meets the old gunslinger? The way he meets them is by murdering 2 or 3 impoverished, drunk Mexicans.
This is true. It's like the need for basically missions to end with kind of action, you know, kind of a fight sequence. It means that there's an utterly insane amount of remorseless, extraneous death. And definitely insanely so in GTA 4.
Yes, because Nico Bellic is a character who is in a very different world, but suffers from essentially the same problems as John Marston does.
Yeah, so Nico Bellic's case, a lot of the similar themes are happening in Red Dead Redemption and in Rockstar's GTA 4. In Red Dead Redemption, it's a man that's had a life of crime, and he is forced to plunge into that life of crime again against his will in order to save his family. In GTA 4, it's a similar sort of thing. A man that he knows he has a dark side to him. He's trying to get away from that. He's trying to prove to himself that he can make a new life. He doesn't need to resort to his old ways.
Although he is also looking for revenge or closure of some kind.
So a lot of the storyline, obviously, I won't spoil what happens, but he's looking for men from the old country, wherever it is he comes from, it's not really specified, who betrayed him in some way. And he's going to America to get away from his old life, but also commit this one last act of revenge. And a lot of the game is about, as he progresses, when he sees the pointlessness of the violence around him within Liberty City, whether when it comes to the crucial moment, whether he can really get revenge on this guy, whether it's worth it.
And there are some sections of the game in which you are offered up the ability to save or kill a man. I mean, there's a very early example where you're chasing a man across some rooftops for some information, and he ends up hanging off the side of the rooftop, and you are given the option to help him up or leave him, and the implication being that he will fall to his death. The problem here is that when you run through streets racking up hundreds of kills, committing Grand Theft Auto, and essentially doing as many immoral things as you can possibly think of, why would you have any problem over the decision to save or kill one man?
Definitely, I think the structure of the game does devalue the weight of its own moral decisions and, in fact, of its own story. There is an awful lot of, you kill hundreds, and I mean hundreds and hundreds of people in GTA 4. The fact that suddenly, almost randomly, you'll decide that somebody is more important than all of those people means it breaks that feeling of believability once again. You can't believe that life matters when the previous 15 minutes has had you knocking about 5 police helicopters out of the air of a rocket launcher.
It's true. When Nico Bellic talks about the hard times in the old country and how he's trying to make a better life for himself, it's very, very hard to believe him when you, as the player, have committed all these atrocious crimes and gotten away with them.
Early on in GTA 4, there's a section of it which is brilliantly written, acted, fairly heartbreaking, in which Nico Bellic goes to the house of a criminal that he works for, and he basically sits with the wife of this criminal, and they discuss the old country, which they both came from. And there is a section in which Nico mournfully describes the war, describes people, children being lined up and shot, how people that would do these things have no soul, and how he worries for the sanctity of his own soul. And it's a really sad, poignant moment. But unfortunately, that's followed by this cutscene ending, me immediately going outside and punching a man directly in the face, stealing his car, and in driving into the group of people.
Exactly. These are not the ways that you create believable characters. And the open world of GTA is just as colourful as the single-player missions.
I think what we can see is the issue here is that Rockstar maybe, within the kind of game they're making, may have characterised their characters too much. Because I've got nothing but praise for the writing and the acting of the character of Nico Bellic and John Marsden. But the world they're in kind of undermines them when they're so well drawn, the fact that anything you do can undermine that character is not so good.
So the point you're sort of making is that to make a believable character, it's not solely down to story. It has to be run through the whole game, including the gameplay.
One approach that you get across in a lot of games can be that if I don't want to characterize my character too much because anything the player does will undermine that, you can make that character quite neutral. Examples of that recently would be Mass Effect, Alpha Protocol, and looking further back, things like Deus Ex. So that's where you definitely have a genuine named character. You play him, but he talks, he has his own personality. But the developers, very much on purpose, have made them quite neutral. So in the case of Commander Shepard in Mass Effect, he has a relatively monosyllabic voice. He has a very, very generic face. And because they made him such a neutral character, nothing that anyone really does in Mass Effect can really undermine it. If anything, his kind of blank, steely stare when he's confronted with any of his moral choices, you know, which we talked about last week, means that whether I choose to save this busload of people, shoot this busload of people, the delivery of it means that I can go, okay, yeah, that's something Commander Shepard would do.
So this is like the Doom style of design in that you remove data from the design and then the player will project onto it themselves and create a more rich experience.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, this isn't taking it quite that far, but yeah, this would be probably a neat point to go on to that. So the logical extreme of this kind of approach about making characters who support the gameplay is making the character, of course, totally silent.
And the best example of this is
Half-Life?
Definitely.
If Half-Life needs explanation to you, then you'll probably have clicked on the wrong podcast and you may think you're listening to Gardening by Design. Half-Life, Valve's seminal shooter from 1998, of course, the sequel in 2004, I believe, has you as a scientist, Gordon Freeman. Gordon Freeman he has a face. We know what he looks like. He's everyone's favourite ginger scientist.
You know what he looks like based on the box art alone. He's never seen in-game.
Yes. So there's a weird kind of thing going on with Half-Life. And Half-Life is by no means the only example of this. It's in fact become very popular as a result of Half-Life. So Gordon Freeman is an iconic gaming symbol, but he never talks. The idea being that they'll believe that anything, any personality you give to Gordon Freeman, anything that he says, would undermine the illusion of you being Gordon Freeman.
And another point is that you spend so much of that game alone that it would be weird if you did speak.
So yeah, in Half-Life, it's very much a game about isolation. It's about survival. It's not a game in which what Gordon Freeman thinks about anything is in any way relevant. It's just that immersion of imagining if I was in this horrible situation, how would I feel? And the fact that Gordon Freeman doesn't say anything means you can really build up that feeling of horror.
The problem with him never speaking at all is, as you say, it works in Half-Life because you have very little human interaction as Gordon Freeman. But in Half-Life 2, you have struck up a friendship with a few people, most notably the internet's favourite, Alex.
Yeah, it made sense that Half-Life continued in this vein for the sequel. I mean, it is, after all, Valve's thing. But in Half-Life 2, the fact that there is so much more interaction, you know, Alex Vance talks to you a lot, her dad, Eli, various other scientists and various NPCs talk to you. And these are actual conversations. And the fact that Gordon Freeman continues not to speak, even when directly asked his own opinion, means that that believability maybe is slightly broken.
It makes you feel slightly psychopathic. In fact, they Valve are aware of this, and there are jokes made in there in that people always refer to him as quiet, or you are a quiet one. But the thing is, if he has never spoken, I don't know what the time span of Half-Life is, but let's say in the last few years, then how did he form these well-rounded relationships with these people? Surely at one point he must have at least had to identify himself and say what his mission objective was.
The assumption may be that Gordon Freeman does talk, it's just being omitted from the game. I genuinely don't know.
So there is a time where Alex introduces herself and Gordon Freeman says nothing at all, yet she doesn't seem worried about this or even confused about this. She seems to think that's perfectly normal.
I only am very forgiving of it in Half-Life because, as I said, it's kind of a Half-Life thing. But it's true, it doesn't really make sense, but you kind of forgive it because it's a video game, it's Half-Life, and of course it's a bloody awesome video game.
Does Gordon Freeman's lack of ability to speak make him more or less of a believable character?
Gordon Freeman is not in any way trying to be written as a character, in that he's more of a kind of an avatar. He's like a cipher. He is a player in this world. They never go into, aside from a small letter in the opening in the first page of the Half-Life 1 manual, alluding to his past at university. But he don't go into any detail about where he comes from, what he thinks, what he wants. He is, in all senses, really, just an avatar. I don't think... it's important to realise when discussing believable characters that it's not necessarily the developer's goal to make the character believable.
You're saying in the case of Half-Life that the believability of the character is not important?
Yeah, because it seems very much intentional that he is just the player.
So they never set out to make a believable character, but side effect of what they did do is create a believable character by allowing Gordon Freeman to just be a device, an avatar, through which you project your own thoughts, opinions.
What Valve probably did was to look at the fact that I want to immerse the player in this world, and I don't want to create a character, Gordon Freeman, give him thoughts, a voice, which in any way would undermine the experience or make me lose that connection with him. The worst thing that Half-Life could have done is characterize Gordon Freeman and make Gordon Freeman a bit of a twat, because immediately you would break that experience. And I think they went for the kind of direction where Gordon Freeman is utterly blank. He's a face, he's a suit, he's a gun pointing into the screen. He is a presser of buttons and a puller of levers, but he is not a man.
Would Half-Life have worked if it were third person rather than first person?
Interesting. Maybe. I think that it would have worked still as, you know, the brilliant bit of game design that it is. But certainly there's a degree of atmosphere which you only get in the first person when you see the world through his eyes, which made you feel, however briefly and however, like, no, not really genuinely, you feel like you are Gordon Freeman.
Yeah, you do. And I think with that other layer of extraction, if it were third person, you would maybe not feel like you were Gordon Freeman. You'd be able to see him walking and you'd see all the broken animation and the clipping and the things like that. And it wouldn't feel like you were him.
I think a neat contrast to this would be Dead Space, which is the third-person horror shooter where you play an engineer called Isaac Clarke, who is forced to walk around a big spaceship chopping aliens into bits. In the original Dead Space, Isaac Clarke does not talk at all. The only noise he makes is a kind of excitable grunt when he stamps on the face of a monster. Dead Space 1 does the mistake of overly characterizing Isaac Clarke to the point where the fact that he then continues to not speak seems odd. So Isaac Clarke, we know a lot more about him. We know what the back of his head looks like, crucially in the opening. We know that he had a girlfriend. He presumably was quite keen on her. She died. He's quite sad about this. When he goes to this ship with Yoshimura and these evil monsters called the Necromorphs appear, it dredges up a lot of old memories. Ghosts of his girlfriend start appearing. And he's also accompanied again by many NPCs who are commanding Isaac in this quite horrific situation to go up and down the ship repairing parts of it, fixing engines and whatnot. So the fact that Isaac Clarke continues to not voice any sort of opinion about the situation seems borderline stupid. We know so much about him. We know he's a person with face, a past. He's got genuine weight to him as a person, but he seems to just blandly accept the fact that he is being ordered around the ship into absurd danger to fix pipes.
So how would you make the character more believable? You say the fact that he's mute doesn't work. I mean, is this a case where you should just develop it in cutscenes only, or would you like to hear triggered audio based on certain events what the player does in-game?
The actual design of it, I mean, it can be done either way, and I'm not necessarily suggesting that Dead Space 1 he should have had a voice, which of course in Dead Space 2 he does. It's that there's almost too much to Isaac Clarke for him to not speak. So you feel like, yeah, when people talk to him in his ear, you get a new objective, say, go down there and turn that thing on, Isaac. There's no kind of, that's a bit dangerous. Should I be doing that, you know?
Because you know so much about the character already and so much has been projected onto him, you can no longer project yourself onto the character, and thus the illusion that was created in Half-Life has been destroyed already in this game.
If you build him up too much as a character, you then start to think, okay, I know this Isaac Clarke, I know that he's a middle-aged man who's done this, isn't this, why isn't Isaac Clarke talking?
And it's a very popular methodology that was used a lot back in the early days of gaming, mostly due to technical constraints. I mean, as I said, Doom has a one-screen introduction, and you don't know much about the character or the scenario.
It still comes up today. For example, I don't think the character in Killzone talks outside of cutscenes. So there's a kind of odd situation where they make the characters mute during the gameplay and then make them incredibly talked in other places. Things where it feels like this kind of silent character thing has fallen so easily into vocabulary of designing first-person shooters that it is applied almost without thought.
I always have the same problem when I play Call of Duty games. And Call of Duty games are sort of unique in that you don't play one character, you play several. And I always find it difficult to know which character I am, what this character that I'm playing at the current time is trying to do, because it's all speaking at you. And the only difference between one character and the next is the people around you call you a slightly different name.
Yeah, I think they do change it in Black Ops, because I believe the man you are playing does talk during the gameplay. But definitely in the case of Modern Warfare 2, which is probably one of the most over-complex, clumsily plotted games I've played since Tribes Vengeance. You jump between the characters, I think you play Soap McTavish at some point, other random undercover man at some point. And yeah, the fact that your character doesn't talk and he's not characterised means that the jump between separate characters seems utterly unnecessary, because you're not jumping between different characters. They're not characters.
Exactly. It's a good case of a game where they should have maybe projected more onto the characters, so that when you're in the character, you're like, right, I know this guy, I know his backstory, I know what I need to do. But again, they've left it quite blank.
But I don't think there's much room for projecting, really. You play these people in 10-minute bursts of incredibly loud, mindless violence, and there's not really anywhere to put the person behind it. So the fact that you play different people seems largely unnecessary.
Yes, it is true. And you might wonder if they care about creating believable characters. But in some of those games, they have very emotional scenes where they try and make things emotional. So if you don't care about the character that you're playing, or your character isn't believable, then how are they ever going to hope that these emotional scenes have any payoff?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could say that in the case of Call of Duty, they just don't fucking care. Because these are, you know, they're over-the-top Hollywood action fodder. They don't really care if you relate to the character of Soap McTavish. We just know that he's Scottish and he's angry.
Another believable character that I really like in a game that has been praised greatly is Batman in Batman Arkham Asylum. I think the game is so successful because people who play it, and this is a thing that I've heard a lot, people who play it say, I felt just like Batman. I think it's a very good example of a believable character. And it is because, as Batman, you don't do anything that Batman would not do.
Definitely. I mean, I always feel like Batman. Batman Arkham Asylum is actually a really good opportunity to talk in about a kind of wider issue. But the other really big issue, I think, when talking about believable characters, is what makes Batman so successful is that you always feel like Batman, you always feel empowered. You think, I like being Batman. Batman's cool. Isn't it great for time Batman? What is more important, I think, when discussing believable characters, is that really the goal of games isn't so much for characters in games need to be believable, is that if you are going to play a character, that character needs to be not annoying. It needs to be something that you can relate to and you can build this connection to. What makes Batman so good is that you are never forced to watch slack-jawed in horror as Batman falls down a hole or gets betrayed by somebody and just sit there, you know, defenseless, holding a little PlayStation or Xbox controller. You know, it's very important. I think what makes Batman so successful is that you are just always cool.
That is a very good point. And Batman does get tricked in that game. He gets tricked by Scarecrow's nerve gas. But what is very neat about what they've done is it's not immediately obvious to Batman in the game that he's been tricked. And it's not immediately obvious to the player.
Yeah, so I think you don't really get the kind of, oh, Batman, you're being so stupid, Batman. Whereas, yeah, you're discovering alongside Batman that something is going on. So, yeah, Batman's wandering around, you know, he's doing this stuff, and, oh, there's a giant scarecrow, there are platforms. Oh, I need to press the middle trigger. There's all sorts of weird stuff going on, but you never feel like, Batman, you idiot, you've walked into an obvious trap.
You're never smarter than the character in the game.
The only exception would be the very beginning of the game, in which, Joker kind of lured you in there, and he was going to trap you in there and release all the inmates from the asylum. But the fact that Batman kind of knows that that's going to happen, from the intro he seems very suspicious, is that kind of, oh, Batman, you know, get caught out. But Batman, he's canny, that Batman. He knew this was going to happen. And of course it turns out, you know, you're so clever, you've got your own secondary Batcave, and, you know, you feel always really on top of it, and you feel like as a character it's good to be.
In fact, what's interesting about that game is sometimes Batman seems cleverer than you. Like, he knows about the second Batcave, but when you find out about it, it is a bit of a revelation.
It's a very strange thing in games in general, which is the kind of, when the character knows more than the player and the player knows more than the character. I think it can be much worse when the player knows so much more than the character that the character's own stupidity And the fact that you're kind of spinning, sort of shouting at the screen, going, come on, whoever you are, don't do that. That's obviously a trap. Is quite irritating. But the fact that Batman knows more than you, and occasionally you just burst into the Batcave too. Batman knew about it because Batman's cool, but you didn't know. And that's exciting.
There's also, if I remember correct, very few cutscenes in that game.
Yes, that's
true. And I think this might be an important point, because Half-Life has no cutscenes and Batman has very few. I think cutscenes, the problem with them is they take so much control away from the player that you suddenly realise that you're playing a game. And I think that does go some way to detracting from the believability of a character.
Yeah, I think that characterization can obviously, you know, it occurs in cutscenes, and I think that's the easy way. And I think for a lot of times it's probably the only way. Some games, you know, to relate to the elements of the plot, but definitely the best games can characterize through the gameplay. Through what the player does, you can build a picture of who they are. Maybe a big problem with a lot of narrative-led kind of action games, the sort of games we're talking about this evening, is that because they are so action-packed, so full of violence, there isn't time to build up those nuances, to characterize people for what they do. I think it's notable that the only reason that maybe video games, say, have less believable characters than films or books, is that films and books tend not to be 10-hour-long scenes of violence and gore. You need that kind of downtime to build a person. The reason that Nathan Drake, from Uncharted's fame, is such a believable character is that not just in the cutscenes, but yeah, through every action, the things he says, even the way he moves, you build up a picture of him as a person. So many like really brilliantly subtle touches, like when Nathan Drake runs under gunfire and the way that he shrugs and ducks his head down, the way he slides the cover panting and goes, oh shit, and other cool things like that. You see through the gameplay, you get a picture of who they are.
Definitely, and there are moments where there are puzzles in the game, and as you are solving the puzzles, he's explaining what he's doing to the NPC that he is with, and through that, it's believable. Like, the weird actions that you as a player are doing, Nathan Drake is seemingly understanding in the game.
Yes, yeah, and I think that's very, very good point.
And it's a great thing that I really like, which sort of makes a character more believable, but it's a very minor touch that most game developers wouldn't bother with, is that there's a bit in Uncharted, the first one, where he goes down to a cave and he doesn't have a torch, and some bats come at him, and he shies away from the bats, and it's completely pointless from a gameplay point of view, and it would have taken time to develop, and a lot of producers would have just cut that out, but it sort of brings you into the world of Nathan Drake. It makes you feel a little bit vulnerable. It makes you realise what kind of character he is. It's just a very nice touch.
I think Nathan Drake is another... Isn't that also a good example of a character who you're very rarely forced to watch them being stupid? I mean, it is a bit of a kind of a cliche to say that video games are teenager, you know, power trips. And there's a kind of element of truth in that. You want to be someone that you feel empowered to be, Nathan Drake. While you are him for that kind of 10 hours of that game, you're thinking, I'm the coolest guy in the world, with cool hair, I know all these pretty girls, we have to all sorts of crazy hijinks. I think Uncharted would be a lot less successful if we were forced to watch him blunderingly be betrayed constantly, or constantly fall down pits, stuff like that. I mean, a lot of games can fall down on this point, where you immediately loses connection with the character you are being because you are forced to watch them do things that you wouldn't do. So, I mean, there's a million examples of these, but a good one would be, quite off the top of the head, Condemned Criminal Origins. So that's Monolith's FBI horror thriller tramp beating up simulator, Xbox 360 launch game, in which you try to build up this character of FBI agent Ethan Thomas. He's kind of like, slightly overweight, middle-aged FBI agent doing his bit. And you think, it's kind of, you know, he's a good everyman. But then you're forced to watch him be the stupidest FBI agent in the world. Be framed for murder based on almost no evidence. Being told by a random character, hey, you've been framed for murder, there's no way you can get out of this. You better run underground and beat up some tramps. A total stranger tells you on the phone, and you go, yeah, fair enough, total stranger on the phone, I'll just go do that. And immediately, the moment you start doing these things, that bond between the player and the character break up. Similar examples would be the emo nature of Squall in Final Fantasy VIII, losing him so many fans when you're forced to watch yourself spend large majority of the game standing by a pillar of your head slightly tilted to one side going, nobody understands me outside the prom. And maybe even again in Red Dead Redemption and its whole, I'm just accepting missions from people when really I'm just getting quite angry now and I want to threaten them.
What you're saying is it's impossible to create a believable yet annoying character because the player themselves doesn't think of themselves annoying, so how can they believe in a character which is annoying?
Definitely, I think that's pretty tricky, because I think making a character as annoying is definitely, I don't think, should ever be a goal in a game. I mean, not from my perspective, maybe someone could, you know, email in and argue otherwise. But what is definitely true, that as a result of this kind of principle, that you want to feel empowered by the characters, but game characters tend to be essentially heroic, which I guess limits the amount of themes that games can kind of explore. I mean, there are examples. Kane and Lynch from a few years ago, where, you know, you play a former mercenary psychopathic murderer and his self-medicated crazy-ass partner who basically wander around the world committing atrocious crimes. They are incredibly evil characters. And in fact, they're remorselessly evil. And you play them, yet they work, because I think there's a kind of depth to why they're doing what they're doing.
There's a sort of bravado and enjoyment in the craziness.
Yeah, yeah. And there is justifications, no matter how slight, to what they're doing. There feels, you know, there's reasons behind their evil. And you could kind of play along with that evil, so even though you're not playing a good person, it's okay because you're not playing an annoying person. You can relate to them on some level. You can build a relationship with them, even if it's not a relationship where, you know, you can understand them.
Okay, so I have another quick and easy thing that will instantly make a character unbelievable. Breaking the fourth wall. And our favourite case of this, one that we still laugh about today, and it is a game that I genuinely do love, but it is silly, is The Godfather 2. Basically, it instantly breaks the fourth wall because you get these tutorial videos that basically tell you how to play the game, and it's a man with a thick, stereotypical Italian accent telling you how to basically use the menus and how to move around the world, how to shoot, how to use the in-game map. And he does it in character as a mafia boss, but makes always allusions to the buttons that are in the physical world. And another good example of this is God of War 3, which has a Guitar Hero moment, which is completely ludicrous, breaks the fourth wall entirely. And I just wonder what they were thinking when they were creating those assets in design.
Are you not going to do your impersonation of the man from The Godfather 2?
We both know that you do it better.
You gotta press the triangle button. You gotta press the triangle button, and then you can ruffle this guy up. Go to the dance view. You press select, go to the dance view. And once you press select, you can press square to summon your mafiosos.
And it also happened in a game that I'm playing at the moment, Sly 1, 2, and 3. Always it's like, hey, do you remember how to do the spire jump? Well, you gotta press X and circle. Why do characters do this? Instantly, you've got the jarring disconnect between in-game world and real world, and it just makes you realize that it is just a layer, a game.
I can see why it doesn't exactly help to build believable worlds and believable characters. It can be quite fun, though.
We've spoken a lot about how different ways you can create believable characters, and all the characters that we have described have been people that you physically play. Is there enough depth in the discussion of creating believable NPCs?
No, there isn't. And let's remedy that slightly now. Because creating NPC characters that are believable is, I'd say, arguably an easier job. I mean, you know, they're like the secondary characters in a film or in a book or in anything, really.
It's true. I guess that you not having control over them means that the designer has complete scope and realm to flesh out their backstory and not make them do anything out of character.
Yeah, I think NPCs, they're the ones that are there to kind of relate the plot, tell you what's what, introduce you to the world, and as such, they can often have a degree of depth that the character actually doesn't have.
That is entirely down to script writing.
Certainly, NPCs in games can fall down a lot.
There's a great bug that I discovered in Red Dead Redemption, and I haven't told you about this before, is that you finish a mission and you speak to a woman and she's not very happy with you. I can't remember exactly what she says, but she's very angry and she says this in a very thick Mexican accent. And I was like, okay, that's mission done. And then the same character turns round, and then due to a bug in the code, she instantly became one of those people who need help out in the open world. So I saved her, and she had a completely different voice. Was all of a sudden like, oh, thank you very much, you're a very nice man.
I mean, my favourite example has always been the Elder Scrolls 4 Oblivion. Some of the NPC behaviour can be utterly absurd due to the kind of, almost like the way that conversations kind of slot in to people. So, for example, you can ask anyone in the game world if they have any rumours about the Grey Fox, the famous fox being a kind of famous mythical thief, and nobody really knows where they are. Where this kind of slightly falls down is when you are to later meet the Grey Fox. One of the conversation topics is, do you know any rumours about the Grey Fox? To which, of course, he'll reply in a different voice from his regular Grey Fox voice, no, I know nothing about the Grey Fox. And while it still says in the bottom left of the screen, you are talking to the Grey Fox. I think I remember reading once about the games of Looking Glass Studios, a very famous kind of 90s company that did likes of Thief, System Shock, is that when it came time for them to make the original System Shock, they came to the conclusion that they could not make the NPC characters believable at all. Because of restrictions of the technology, restrictions which I still say exist now, because, you know, you still get NPCs whose dialogue loops endlessly, who stand pointlessly around waiting for you to solve their problems. So Looking Glass, having realised that they could not make characters believable, construct a labyrinthine Shakespearean tragedy of interweaving horror and love and betrayal, and they put it all in audio logs and then killed off the entire cast. So System Shock and System Shock 2 have among the deepest stories of games I've played. The relationship with the NPCs is compelling and sad and brilliant and beautiful, but they're all dead. Because them actually being on the screen would be rubbish, because you'd see an early 90s low-poly model kind of jigging on the spot telling you about how he loves his woman.
Just like Singularity.
That very much blatantly tries to copy the kind of System Shock, Bioshock model of the, you know, the conversation tapes and unveiling the past of the situation slowly through these tapes. But rather than System Shock's kind of interweaving narratives being told through these audio tapes, what Singularity opts for in quite an amusing B-movie style is that every one of these audio tapes would in fact be a person trying to hide from a monster and then being caught and then dying. So you'll click on an audio tape and it will be a man in a, or a woman in a Russian accent going, "I am hiding from the monsters. I think I have escaped, but what's that noise? It's
You have described pretty much every single one of those tapes.
So yeah, then you're going, that's quite horrible. Then you walk around a corner and then you'll pick up another audio tape and it'll be a little girl going, "I think I have found a hiding spot from the monsters, but what is that noise? It's
I have a very tangential question, because a lot of that will get cut. Is Guybrush Threepwood a believable character?
No. Because I don't think it's... It's not Guybrush Threepwood's purview to be a believable character. I mean, as I was saying earlier, it's not so much for the goal of game development is to make, you know, a character believable. It's to make a character one that you can relate to or want to be or accept on some level. Guybrush Threepwood is definitely an unbelievable character. I mean, he, at various points, has been a zombie, died, been swallowed by a whale, become a child, grown up again. You know, he's obviously an unbelievable character in an unbelievable world. But Guybrush Threepwood is one of the most successful, most lovable characters in games because he has a kind of charm. He has something that you like. You want to be him. You want to be around him. It's more a case that Guybrush Threepwood is just a good bit of writing more than he is in any attempt to actually be believable.
So, in summary, Gordon Freeman in Half-Life is seen as a very believable character, and that is because he is essentially mute, and you are left to project yourself upon him. But this doesn't work when you've already been given too much of a backstory, a la Dead Space. Other ways that people do it, and the way that Batman Arkham Asylum works, the character is believable in that he is never tricked, he never does something silly, he never does something that the player themselves would not wish for him to do. Rockstar fails to create believable characters because they have these situations in which the character is very mature and sensible and trying to do these things which the game is not supporting. They task you to do things out of character.
I think that about covers it. I mean, we could talk all day about this subject because I think there are so many other games. I mean, I've got it written down in front of me, but we never really got into talking about Phoenix Wright and how overtly cartoon characters can still be believable because of the emotional depth behind them. I really would have liked to talk a bit more about Alan Wake and trying to create a character that's a dick but still a character you want to be.
Maybe we'll pick up some of these topics in episode 3. Hopefully this will edit down to a nice small size because we've been talking for a very long time. And this is a good point for me to make my outro that wasn't very snappy last week.
No, it wasn't. You could have done better.
Attempt number 2. Here we go. If you have any comments or topic suggestions, you can get in touch at gamingbydesign@gmail.com. Or alternatively, you can check out the blog and leave opinions, rantings, haikus, or advertisements for Viagra. And that blog can be found at gamingbydesign.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week, where we might be discussing handholding in games. Excellent.